Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. We create our stories, and our stories create us. Our guest, Geraldine Brooks, once told the real-life stories of Bosnia, Somalia, and the Middle East as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and in nonfiction books. Now Ms. Brooks uses her reporting skills creating luminous fiction. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel March, revivifying Little Women's remarkable father. Her growing list of novels includes People of the Book, a many-layered adventure story spanning four continents and 500 years. Ms. Brooks is keenly aware that good stories, fact or fiction, are vital to democracy, and so is education, she knows, public education for everyone, not just the privileged few.
My kid is in the public school, and it is a fantastic school. So I think we generalize too much. This school is doing a wonderful job of getting kids where they come in, including immigrant kids who don't have any English when they arrive, but I tell you what, they're reading and writing beautifully when they leave. So I think that we're too hard on our public schools. It depends on the support that they're getting from their local communities.
Geraldine Brooks is a gifted writer. In addition to March and People of the Book, many also know her for Year of Wonders, a memorable fictional account of the Black Death in England. Her nonfiction includes Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, and Foreign Correspondence. A native of Australia, Ms. Brooks and her American writer husband, Tony Horwitz, live with their family on Martha's Vineyard after many years in rural Virginia. With such a diverse past and present, Bill Russell and I knew many stories awaited us as we greeted Geraldine Brooks, a storyteller as lively in conversation as she is gifted in print. Geraldine Brooks, I have learned many wonderful things over the course of many, many, many programs, and one of them that gives me particular delight is from physics, and I am an innocent in physics until welcoming some world-class physicists. And the guy who more or less invented string theory opened to me, yes, right.
What?
Opened to me.
Am I in the wrong studio?
Well, let me tell you, that's kind of how I felt. What he told us was that the string theorists think that there may be as many as a very large number, 10 to the 500th universes. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, well, of course, I read novels. I know there are that many universes. Isn't that kind of what a novel opens for us, is a whole universe?
I hope so, isn't it? It's nice to think of it that way, but I'm also a big admirer of Jane Austen's view that, you know, the business of a novel is four or five families in a country village and, you know, you burrow in to the microcosm. So I don't know what the opposite of the string theorist view is, that you should be able to go into parallel but alien worlds, but you also should look very deep at the world that you inhabit every day and try and see what you can draw from that.
One of the other scientists we've talked to is more or less in your camp. He, Edward Wilson, E.O. Wilson, talks about a Magellanic voyage around a tree trunk.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And spending a lifetime in a Magellanic voyage around a tree trunk, which is, I think, your view, Jane Austen's view.
But on the subject of string theory, I once had a very kind and patient physicist try to explain this to me. And it had to do with the Golden Gate Bridge and an ant. And that's all that's stuck with me.
Well, I guess that's my fault.
Actually, what he was doing was talking about the ant going around the cables.
He was, you know it.
It's those 11 dimensions.
Yeah. Well, I really do find that there is charm in that, because it is easy to forget that the everyday world is just the everyday world, and it has all of this richness that getting up and washing your face and going to work, we forget. But that ability to go into places that one doesn't know exist is a gift that you give to the world. But it's also a gift to yourself, isn't it?
Well, I always feel like, you know, I wake up these mornings and I've got ahead of me a day alone in a room, and it is the greatest privilege in the world to be able to go and just imagine stuff. And I never forget what a privilege that is.
Well, you go and imagine stuff, and you are a world-class reporter. So it isn't that you just make stuff up. The whole context is enriched by your seriousness about finding stories on which you can build and looking into what has happened and building from that. So it isn't simply a blank page. It's that and you and life and reporting all coming together.
Yeah, I find that reporting is really a very helpful background for me as a novelist in two ways. One is that when the plot tells you what you need to know, you've got the tools to find it. And with people of the book, that I can't tell you what I didn't know when I started that book. And the intellectual journeys that it took me on researching it, I just loved the research for that book more than perhaps any of the others.
More than writing it?
Research and writings like this for me, you can't really pick them apart. I'm not a big fan of doing a pile of research and then figuring out a story that fits it. I like to be writing away, and the story tells me what I need to know, and then I go and find it out, come back and work it in until I get to another place where I need to know something. So that's how that works for me. But the other thing that I think having been a reporter does for you is it makes you very unprecious about writing.
Oh,
you don't wait to get your aura on straight. And I went to Columbia Journalism School, and one day the wonderful newspaper man, Jimmy Breslin, came and talked to my class, and he said, writing is bricklaying, and the words are your bricks, and you just have to lay them down side by side, and some days your wall will go up straight and true, and those are the good days, and other days it'll be a really bad wall, and you'll just have to knock it over, but at least you have something, you can look at it, and you can figure out why it didn't work.
That's fabulous. Thank you, Jimmy Breslin. And thank you, Geraldine Brooks. We'll be back in a moment for a good deal more. Please be with us. Welcome back. It is our great pleasure to be with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Geraldine Brooks. You were talking about Columbia. You took the course. You weren't teaching the course. That's very interesting because it says to me that one, even as a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, continues to learn.
Oh, no, this was back in the days when dinosaurs walked the earth.
That was before the Pulitzer.
Oh, yeah, it was
BP and AP, is that how it goes?
No, I had worked as a reporter in Sydney, and I was lucky enough to get a scholarship named for a very distinguished foreign correspondent, Greg Shackleton, who'd been killed by the Indonesian army in East Timor. And I went off to school in New York City very wide-eyed. And,
oh, I'll bet.
And was lucky enough to hear from great, great newspaper people like Breslin, and Roger Angel came, and, you know, everybody drops in at Columbia. So
that must have been beautiful.
What was it that made you make the transition from being a reporter to a writer? And then to a novelist.
Reporters are writers.
Well, but it's a very different profession, and it's all words, but they are words that do different things and have different predicates.
Exactly. I had written one book while I was still a journalist, which was my first book, Nine Parts of Desire, but it was very much a journalist book, and it was exploring what I had learned as a correspondent in the Middle East. Particularly about the women of Islam and the different ways they negotiated their lives in some pretty tough situations. So I took a leave from the newspaper to do that book, and then I went back to daily journalism, and I really loved being a journalist. I really, every bit of it was fantastic. But
and you did work for a world-class newspaper.
Worked for the Wall Street Journal for getting on for 14 years, I think. But
now that's the writer's part, is a world-class journalist. The editorial, we'll negotiate that.
Oh, man, those things almost gave me an aneurysm.
Yes.
But that was the beauty of the journal, because the news pages and the editorial page were very different. And I used to say, you know, are they sure they know they hired a feminist tree-hugging pinker?
From Australia?
But they didn't care, you know, and
actually, they probably went out of their way to do that.
Probably did, but we never got second guest on stories, and that was wonderful. So I hope that continues under the new regime.
Indeed, don't we all? So you had been reporting for these 14 years for the journal and wrote the Nine Shades of Design?
Nine Parts.
Parts. Well, it's the idea of being able to genuinely explore from experience women's, Islamic women's lives, pre being able to do that very subtly with novels. I would think that's a dance almost, that the two would join hands and form a circle for you.
Well, the frustrating thing about journalism, which is its great strength, is that you're not allowed to make anything up or even speculate, really. So you can go as far as the facts take you, but no farther. And when you get to the end of the string of facts, you must stop. But with fiction, you can research until you know what is known, and then you've got the license to take the great leap and say how you thought it might have been, and you draw on all kinds of different emotional truths and experiences to make that imaginative jump. But it is so much fun to have the license to do that.
Are you going to quote Richard Slotkin?
No, actually, I'm going to...
Richard Slotkin is an historian, a world-class historian, who says that when he has the facts and knows what happens, he writes his history and wins big prizes to do it and all that. But when he knows what happened and can't prove it, then he writes novels.
Yeah, well, exactly.
We have a good friend who is a world-class anthropologist, wrote a book called Unsettled, History of the Jewish People. It is, in Mel Konner's inimitable fashion, thorough. Mm-hmm. He's an excellent writer, and it is, you know, probably 700, 800 pages on the history of the mm-hmm. Jewish people.
An anthropology of the Jewish people, as he puts it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some ways, not to take nothing away from Mel's book, certainly what I think you accomplish is a thousand-year history,
mm-hmm.
Succinctly. Mm-hmm. You know, just certain key parts. Obviously, there's a great deal left unsaid, but what you do say is, by and large, certainly outside of the Jewish community, very unfamiliar, mm-hmm. and that flow of events from Spain to Italy,
in 1492,
to Venice, to the Balkans is a remarkable story. In many ways, it's a story of Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
or at least
yeah.
our history. Though the English don't figure prominently in this,
She took care of that when she was doing Year of Wonders. When she did the English, it's okay.
Moving slowly to the east, right? We'll be in Australia soon. That novel you've been wanting to write about Australia, but it goes to this: the particularly for the uninitiated, that ability to draw conclusions, to finish out the pieces of the pattern that you're able to do in a novel that you can't do in reporting,
mm-hmm.
Is in some ways extraordinarily valuable for ignorant readers like me.
Yeah, I think even to some extent in some of the way Jewish history is presented, even in the Jewish community, is very Holocaust-centric.
Absolutely.
And I think going back into the past to show the patterns that have repeated themselves of tolerance followed by persecution, some people have, you know, who are quite surprised by that history.
And well, particularly in America, yeah. You know, the 1492 to Americans has one meaning and yeah. one meaning only,
yeah.
and that's the so-called discovery of America.
Mm.
1492 in Spain is a radically different event than certainly 1492 to either a Jew or a Muslim.
Well,
actually, a non-Catholic Christian
yeah.
Was mm-hmm. a very different experience.
Interestingly, one of the great eyewitness accounts of the expulsion of the Jews in 1492 comes to us from Columbus.
Really?
Yeah, as he was getting his expeditionary ships, you know, he's down at the dock with the Chandlers and all that, and he saw this pathetic, huddled mass of Jews who had been given a date certain in which to leave Spain or else, and he writes a very moving account of them.
The option was to leave Spain, convert, I think.
That's it. Leave Spain or convert.
Or suffer the consequences, which was, yeah. you know, either get physically thrown out or killed, imprisoned.
Yeah.
It was
tortured either way.
Well, it was not a
And
not
then
a
if
option.
You did convert, you still might
You still were in a fairly precarious position.
Well, but you sent me back to Torquemada. Thank you very much. And his grandmother had been a Jew. So, I mean, the mix of all of this and your character, who is the persecutor in the Spanish, no, by the time we get to Venice, has come from a Jewish tradition. So the knots, the K-N-O-T knots in all of this are very poignant and real and true to life. Is that part of what is so enticing about the richness of writing novels?
Well, I wasn't sure how true to life it was going to be. You know, I wasn't sure what the, as I said, when I started this book, there was so much I didn't know, and I wasn't sure what the resources would be on the Inquisition era in Spain. And, well, blow me down, the resources are extensive, largely because the Catholic Church took such impeccable note of what it did in interrogations. Yeah, so the interrogations are documented. There was a scribe in the room the whole time, and a lot of it is just the detail of ordinary domestic life, because a lot of what people are being interrogated about is, we saw you choke when you ate a piece of bacon. Does that mean you're revolted by pork? And why did you buy from the kosher butcher instead of in the meat market? And the poor person who's being interrogated says, because he was cheaper that day, you know. And so you get this sort of picture of ordinary domestic life at the same time as, you know, they have this exactitude where they'll even have a sort of parenthetical comment by the scribe saying, he screamed for a long time, you know. So, like many great persecutors, this desire to document what is being undertaken.
Which happened in Nazi Germany, too, in that Holocaust century.
And I'm afraid it happened when we were waterboarding recently, but somebody got rid of the videotapes, didn't they?
Yeah.
One of the interesting and I assume this was intentional, and I'm not even sure I want to know the answer to that. You're setting this in the former Yugoslavia, in Sarajevo. To me, was brilliant, and I don't know whether you worked forward or backward. And obviously, since you'd been a reporter there, you had some, intellectual but also visceral connections to that community. But part of what is so interesting is in the 20th and the 21st century, we're still dealing with essentially a microcosm of those religious conflicts. We have Orthodox. We have Orthodox Christians, we have Jews, we have Catholics, we have Protestants, we have Muslims, and they're all in this place, and the trouble is still very great and still unresolved.
And we'll come back to Sarajevo in just a moment so I don't have to interrupt what I'm sure will be a rich and important answer from Geraldine Brooks. Please be with us when we return in just a moment. We're delighted to have Geraldine Brooks with us here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, of course, is my co-host. And together we are delighted to be with Ms. Brooks. You may know her for March, which won the Pulitzer Prize. You may know her for Year of Wonders, which is a wonderful book that opens up the plague in England to us and, in a way, in the world. And then, of course, there is People of the Book, which is set at the beginning in Sarajevo, in the times that are current, quite current. And then you bring us back and you fold us through time and place. Speak, please, to the Sarajevo that you experienced as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, what Bill was saying before the break was that this is the kind of religious conflict that's been reenacted over and over again in human history. And yet in Sarajevo, the really remarkable thing was that people aren't very religious there. Mm. And as one of my friends in that, with the wonderful mordant wit of Sarajevo said, this was a war about what church you don't go to on a Sunday.
Saturday or Friday.
The Muslims hadn't cracked the binding on a Quran, you know, in a couple of generations. The Jews thought circumcision was primitive and barbaric and had stopped doing it, and the Orthodox, anyway. So it wasn't really about religious difference. It was just this kind of visceral hatred of the other because he's the other after centuries of peaceful coexistence and a real sort of celebration of diversity. And I think that's why so many Sarajevans didn't believe that this war would ever touch them. Mm. They saw it happening in Croatia down on the coast. They watched the shelling of the beautiful city of Dubrovnik and went, oh, dear, like we all did. And they didn't think it had anything to do with them. So they didn't really believe the war when it came to them. And that's why nobody was really prepared for it. And in particular, the museum was not prepared for it. And that's where the Sarajevo Haggadah, which is the Hebrew manuscript from 14th century Spain, which gave me the seed of the idea for People of the Book, was residing, and it was at risk. And so it was when I was there as a newspaper reporter and I heard about this manuscript and that it was missing and nobody knew what its fate was. That's, I guess, where the seeds for the novel were planted.
Well, I have to go fast forward. You find the book in the People of the Book. They have found the book.
They did, in fact, find the book. Well, it wasn't lost, actually. A very courageous Muslim librarian who wasn't in denial, realized that this war might be serious and it might be long-term and it might be very destructive. So he risked his life to go in under shelling and bring this book to a safe place where he hid it for the duration of the war.
Was that the crown jewel of the museum?
Absolutely.
The sense of how much is saved in a museum sometimes gets lost. It's not just a tourist attraction. Museums can hold who we are in very serious ways.
Well, there are very, very important collections in the Bosnian National Museum, including the bones of the kings and queens of the earliest period.
How far back does that go?
Oh, you'd be testing me now. It always drives my husband crazy.
Oh, I can't, I'm not testing
I can't
you.
Do I just, dates.
No, I don't want dates, my dear. I don't
well
do
into,
dates
well into
centuries.
Well before.
ADDC.
Millennium, probably.
Let's just go with
way
millennium.
Even thousands.
A long time, Paula.
A long time. And there were unbelievable natural history collections there, really important documentations that scientists really required. And he did his best with those things, but it was the Haggadah that he really wanted to bring to a safe place.
You also point out that part of the problem in Sarajevo was that, being relatively civilized people, they assumed the civilized world would impose themselves, interject themselves into this conflict before it reached anywhere near the state, because we were all sitting and watching this happen.
We were.
This was not going on some place where we did not have access.
That's right.
You know, across the street from Italy and up the road from Greece and down the street right over from
Vienna.
Vienna and Switzerland.
Yeah.
So this was not a mystery. But I say that in the context, in terms of you expect civilization to do better than that. What you say about museums is the same thing that happened in Baghdad. You know, we let that same kind of phenomenon occur. We were the participants of it, in effect, we Americans.
Let's see, America's going to attack Baghdad, but Americans don't protect the museum.
Well, and part of the lesson in this book, and what I find just luminous about it, not to say illuminated, is the how it just keeps holding up a little piece of a mirror. Now, we're a complete piece, but a little piece of a mirror to us, but doing that through the history and histories that go back not quite a millennium, but a long time. And it's humbling because the mirror, it turns out in many cases, to be extraordinarily accurate. And I would think that might be depressing.
Well, I don't think it is depressing, because what happens with this little codex, and this is based on the truth, as we know, the truth in living memory for the last 150 years or so, but the truth that the book testifies to is that it always found its protectors. So very ugly things might be happening around it, but the book was at the center of some really beautiful acts of courage and outreach by people who would not be taken in by this ideology that the other is despicable, and actually felt the shared humanity and the shared intellectual history that this book represented. And two rescues we know of a Hebrew book by Muslim hands, and then once by a Catholic priest in Venice in 1609.
And we know that for a fact.
We know that that happened because the priest in question was a censor working for the Pope's Inquisition, and his job was to root out heretical Jewish books and burn them. And this book came under his hand, and he wrote three little Latin words that proclaimed that there was nothing against the Catholic Church in the book, and so it was saved from being burned in Vienna that year. In Venice, I mean, that year.
I found that one of many things, the stereotypes that you broke for me, was thinking about Germany when Hitler rose, said, oh, well, this can't happen here. Mm. America, as we've turned away from some of our more enlightened thinking, has gone through this, oh, well, that can't happen here. It can always happen when one is not vigilant.
It's happening. It's happening. Who would have thought that we would have been using torture techniques from the Spanish Inquisition?
And we were.
And we maybe still are. And that we don't even know that, this open society, that so much information has been closed to us. I'm also really troubled by the little bits that dribble out about how female service personnel, idealistic young women who have signed up to serve their country, have been used, basically pimped by the military in these disgusting interrogations where they have to use their sexuality to humiliate the prisoner being interrogated. What have we come to that we use our daughters that way?
Well, again, I go back. That's the depressing part of the mirror you hold up. It's also striking in this to me that you dedicate this book to librarians for obvious reasons, but when I saw that, I said, I think I'm going to like this book. and the reason, of course, one of the reasons was that it was the librarians in this country who were the first people, and for a long time, the only more or less organized group who stood up to the absurdities of what
the Civil Patriot Act.
Rights violations, yeah. Civil liberties violations that government, Democrats and Republicans, hands joined. And a great part of the population was the librarians.
Exactly.
You know, those courageous people in the stacks behind the desk.
Yeah.
The heroes, to this point right now, are librarians.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I was thinking of many things when I wrote that dedication. One was the important role librarians played in my childhood, because we didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up. The library was crucial part of our life. My parents were avid readers, and we would all go to the library and come home with huge stacks of books.
And this is still in Australia.
Yeah, and I thought that was fantastic. But there were librarians who really not just risked their lives, but gave their lives in Sarajevo when the National Library of Bosnia was shelled with phosphorus bombs deliberately to burn it down. 10% of the collection was saved by a human chain of librarians, and one of those, a woman named Aida Vitorovic, was actually killed in the process of trying to save those books. So all those things were in my mind when I wrote that dedication. But yes, we do have to thank them for their guts to stand up to the Patriot Act and all the sort of miniature little civil liberties things that happen in county libraries all the time when people want to take books out of the children's section and so forth.
Charles Darwin comes to mind.
Well, and these are indeed people of the book.
Indeed.
We're with Geraldine Brooks. We'll be back in just a moment. We trust you'll be here too. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. And certainly Geraldine Brooks is a person who takes us to the leading edge, holds our hands, and we go across together. People of the Book is the specific book that brought you to us, but inasmuch as I can never resist a good novel, I said, well, she's written one good novel, let's see what the others are. So I inhaled deeply and have enjoyed both March and Year of Wonders. So I think I've read all of the novels you've written. I'm going to have to wait for the next ones. But what brings it to mind specifically was your title, and as we were talking about librarians, the power of words. And people say, oh, books are going to go away. I don't think so. The power of words, the very technology of a book, I think have a permanence now in the human experience that we walk away from to our peril. Does that seem right to you?
Yes. I hope that the physical book survives, because even though I'm not that materialistic. I really do love to own the hardcover books by the authors that I admire, and I just love them as a thing. And I think that it's a pretty fantastic invention, very practical, very portable, it endures. So, you know, why go past it? And a couple of weeks ago, I would have said there was no future for this electronic book. But my husband, Tony Horwitz, had a fellowship at the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University in Providence. And the John Carter Brown Library is nerds on parade. The people there are as serious as you can get.
No card catalog.
And he walked into that room and he saw a whole bunch of people with new Kindles. And he the reporter in him couldn't resist asking, how come? You know, you're a book person. What's with this? And they said, oh, I love books, but my house is almost falling down under the weight of my library. And this is a godsend for the book that you only want to read once.
Well, there's something to that. In terms of thinking about the power of the words that a book carries, and sometimes pictures, when the copy of People of the Book came in, I leapt to the conclusion, jumped to my own stereotype, that this would be about the Talmud. That this would be, okay, People of the Book, it's going to be about Jews and the Talmud. And how do we say that correctly? The Hebrew Bible. And of course it wasn't. But that's part of the delight of you pull me in.
But it is a remarkable midrash.
Yes, indeed, it is a midrash, another interesting concept and storytelling medium that I've only come fairly recently to understand as a teaching tool. This whole business about the richness of words and the way that we are carried by our stories. America needs more good stories, even if they're not happy endings. This happens to come out quite nicely in terms of happy endings. But that's not what you set out to do.
Well, for some of them it does, and for some of them
are not so good.
Depending on which point in the story, specifically...
Don't stop till you get to the end.
The Haggadah is okay.
Yes, the book makes it. So.
Yeah, and the book would have made it had it stopped at any of those points.
The book is the survivor, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the book could have, in a sense, survived even if the physical object had not, because it is a strong story that itself carried.
Oh, yes, but boy, we'd be the poorer for it, because what makes this book so remarkable is its thingness. Mm-hmm. You can feel the intention of the scribe, the sofer, who is a religious man whose role in life is to write holy Hebrew. You can feel the intensity of creative power of the artist who did the illuminations in this book, which makes it such an extraordinary rarity, because at that time it was very unusual for any Hebrew book to have figurative art because of the commandment, thou shalt not make graven images.
Which is a parallel to the Islamic experience, where you also don't do
exactly.
Images.
That's a very serious prohibition in Islam, and was among the Puritans in this country too. They were not crazy about making likenesses. So
I stopped you in your progression. Mm-hmm. We would not have had that same sense coming out of the experience that book had as it traveled with individuals and was enriched by their experiences.
There are a million Haggadot.
Oh,
in the world,
plural?
Yes. And each of them is very recognizable and the stories are very similar. But this one is unique. So
specifically, tell us what the function of this book is.
Well, Haggadah is used at the Jewish Passover festival. It's a book to be used at home at the dinner table when you have the ritual meal at which Jews everywhere remember the liberation of their people from slavery in Egypt. And so it tells that story, but it tells it in a particular way with a lot of symbolism that has to be explained, because the idea of the Seder meal is to teach your children about this momentous time in Jewish history, the progression from slavery to freedom.
Teaching the children is an important concept.
Absolutely. And when I had to come up with a plausible explanation as to why this particular book was illustrated when hardly any other Hebrew books extant from that time were. And so I was thinking about the role of the Passover meal as a pedagogic experience, and that plays a part in the explanation that I came up with.
I have a good friend who's a philosopher. His core philosophy is he says that the meaning of being a human is the creation of beauty. And that's what he's getting, has worked his way to going back, and he's a wonderful scholar of Western philosophy. He doesn't have any claim to the Eastern perspective. And he goes on to say there is no beauty without its opposite, without ugliness. But I think of it in this context because he also talks about the avatars of ugliness, what he characterizes as Vandals and Philistines. The Philistines just, they won't maintain things. They have bad taste. They're lazy. They're sloppy. They pour wine on their books. The Vandals are actively destructive. And the story, and it comes to mind in this context because the history of this book, as you tell it, is there's this beacon of beauty, which is the book itself, and then there are all these Vandals in various forms around it who are committed to the destruction of beauty, usually with some orthodoxy, some ideology behind it. But the overwhelming commitment is to the destruction of beauty and the humans that go with it. And to me, you've wound together a wonderful series of metaphorical experiences that describe that, and again, describe it in ways that are relevant to what we deal with now.
Well, one of the little byways that my research took me down was looking at the Islamic view of image making. As you said, Muslims don't favor figurative art, generally speaking, and actually, in the medieval period, the iconoclasts, the idol smashers, defaced a lot of books, but they did it in a very particular way, because the real issue in Islam is that you're not supposed to be competing with the creator. So you mustn't do anything that looks like it's supposed to be alive. It's okay to have plant forms and abstract designs, and there's great, great beauty in Islamic art, but it's all non-figurative. And so what the iconoclasts would do is they would try and get their hands on some of the beautiful Persian miniatures and other wonderful art that was created within a Muslim context. And if there were people in those miniatures, they would draw a little red slash across their throat, effectively killing them, robbing them of life. So if they were dead people, then that was okay.
But we saw that in Egypt.
Well, you reported for a while from the Middle East and spent time in Cairo, and I'm sure you had the experience of going in to these beautiful, many millennia old
places. Six or seven.
More than I can count. Yeah. And seeing those wonderful works of art that had been literally defaced.
Oh, yes.
The face taken away.
The face was taken off. The rest of it was there, so you could imagine. I mean, you could get a sense of...
Well, and you see the Taliban doing that to Buddhist statues in the last decade, so it's not like this is ancient history.
And to a lot of paintings in the Kabul Museum. There was a very brave curator there that managed to save some of the collection, but they were out for anything that was too representational.
You forced me.
Gently.
No, you took me by the throat and made me revisit the Inquisition, which to me is one of the great horrors of European so-called civilization, and certainly to me an affront to everything that Jesus at least represented. And I couldn't remember, so I went and put in Inquisition and Apology in my search engine to see what would come up. And it was startling to me because the first page was mostly given over to deniers and arguments with deniers, people who say that either it was a Protestant conspiracy that's been promulgated, or it was not as bad as advertised. It was only a few thousand people after all that got burned. Or that it met the standards of behavior of that time period. Now, this is 400 or 500 years, or 700 years, depending on how you count it, of Inquisition. But I found it remarkable. And again, it goes back to this, you know, this mirror that you keep holding up, going back from 1492 to today.
And it's important to say that Pope Benedict came to being pope from being at the head of the church's office that they changed his name, but it's the Inquisition.
It's so the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Thank you.
But I don't say that to necessarily attack the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church has, in some way, the Church itself has at least issued an apology. People quibble about how sincere and how, you know, the wording of it, and I'm sure the translations have something to do with it. But there are a tremendous number of people out there. And this, in a way, goes to Sarajevo. You know, it had nothing to do with religion. It's just religion was the excuse. But there are a lot of people who take, if you will, the iconography, the symbols, and twist them to their own purposes, and simply refuse to see the world in what I would view as, for want of a better word, an enlightened way.
We will be back, having given Geraldine Brooks a moment to think about that, when we return. Please be with us. Geraldine Brooks has honored us with her presence here on The Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell has just brought forth an appalling idea that must make the reporter in you crazy, that things that are known to have happened are rejected by these so-called deniers when you come to something as essential to understand as the Inquisition in European history.
It looks a lot like Holocaust denial.
It does. It has a lot in common with that. But the Inquisition wasn't just one thing. It was in many places, as you said, over several centuries. And it was serving different purposes at different times. But the overarching thing was that it was trying to make sure everybody was doing the right groupthink. And I think that the genius of this country was to say, we don't do that. Your religious beliefs are your own, and keep them in your private life, and we will have a public sphere that is free of that. And I can't believe that people want to give up this great genius idea of America, one of the bedrock ideas of our foundation that has you know, brought us to such a successful place in the world.
But we're still arguing
about that. By giving
up
the right to keep your religion to yourself and leave everybody else in the public square alone.
Bringing church into the political forum is just a horrible mistake, in my view.
We're going to have this discussion again tomorrow with Edward Larson, who's just written a history of the election of 1800. Mm. And it is, obviously it's written by a modern author, so he has the perspectives, a modern perspective, but it is just sort of a carbon copy of where we are today. There were serious establishmentarians in this country. There was an established church. There were established churches in most, if not most of the states. Virginia, I mean, part of the objection to Jefferson was that he had written the statute essentially on religious freedom for Virginia, and that made him an atheist, and that was a lot of what the campaign against him was about. This we thought we were to resolve this argument, and it's still going on. It's still very alive. And
you give pretty good fact-based experience for why we should make this decision in such a way that gives people freedom rather than, as you so elegantly put it, groupthink.
Or coercion. Mm-hmm.
The People of the Book is a wonderful book, and it takes us lots of places we need to be. And I must say, so did Year of Wonders and March. I'm particularly intrigued by March, not just because you won the Pulitzer for it, but because I think that Louisa May Alcott sort of got put over here as little girl literature, and it's not true. Louisa May Alcott comes from a very important part of the American experience that is both the first and second wave of the Great Awakenings and what really happened within the whole group that is Emerson, Thoreau, and her father, Branson Alcott, who was virtually forgotten until you come back and say, let's look at this again. Again, this is part of being a storyteller. Was it Bronson, I didn't say that correctly, sorry, Alcott, who who pulled you to this? Was it Little Women? You credit your mom having said, she's not really that saccharine nice. Nobody. Marmee.
Nobody is such a goody-goody.
Goody-goody, that was it. But it seemed to me that you did that wonderful reporter thing in all three of these of saying, yes, and. That's what we understand, and there's more to be said.
It was such a fantastic time to explore. It was such a radical time. People were really, in the 1830s, when Bronson was in his heyday.
Which is Louisa May Alcott's father.
Father. Living in Concord with Emerson across the road and...
Throw out the woods.
just down the way. And, you know, and all the great thinkers of the time coming through. Margaret Fuller and John Brown came and gave a talk. So there were ardent abolitionists, and they were trying to think about a new spirituality and transcendentalism, and just reformers in every way, women's rights activists and educational radicals. And they were just a stupendously interesting bunch of people, as was Louisa May Alcott. Unfortunately, one of the things that I discovered during the research was that despite the instant success and financial rewards that Little Women brought to her, and she really was the J.K. Rowling of her day, the book was an instant hit. She didn't have much time for it because she felt it was a book she'd written just to satisfy her publishers rather than her own desires as a writer. And she wrote a little line in her journal that just floored me when I read it. She said, "My publisher has asked me for a book for girls. I don't like girls much."
I was one. Well, again, the ability to take fact, and I guess there is a question embedded here, this business that fact and fiction are different seems to me to be wrong.
Oh, no. I would violently disagree. I'm all for the distinction between fact and fiction. And if you write a nonfiction book and it's on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, then everything in it better be true. And I hate this kind of merging where it's become kind of acceptable to change the time frame that things happen, to put yourself in a conversation when you hadn't even come to the city at that point, to do these, what do they call them, composite characters where you take a bit from this and a bit from that. I'm sorry. It's really hard to write a compelling nonfiction narrative. You have to wear out your shoe leather to be there and put yourself out there and witness and witness and witness, because it doesn't usually come out in a perfect little anecdote until you've really sweat blood. So I think it's really devaluing what true nonfiction writers do, this kind of merging of the two genres.
Well, fortunately, James Frey has helped us.
Before him. A book that I absolutely love, John Berendt's Savannah murder mystery, The Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. When I got to the end of that, and he has that disclaimer saying that, you know, this has changed and that's changed, lots of things have changed, but I get closer to the essential truth, I felt like drop-kicking it off the balcony. Because
you felt violated by
Well,
it.
And then I found out that he was putting himself in the room for conversations when one of the parties had been dead and buried before he even came to Savannah. So I don't think that's nonfiction.
Well, and why, you know, there's something about this, you know, it's in the categories. You know, if you call it nonfiction, I think most people would expect everything in there to be the best possible representation of what actually happened. Now, there's always ambiguity.
Well, there is Kurosawa saying what happened from seven different directions.
That's okay.
But that's art.
Yeah. There are different interpretations of the same event, but you, the writer, should be giving it your best shot to tell it as it happened and not try and make it end neatly and tie it up in a bow and make... And you know, many, many writers that I admire have said that they do this. And it really surprised me. And I guess that's the journalistic training coming through, because, you know, you'd be run out of town on a rail if you do it as reporters have been.
Well, I think of John Eidenauer and his colleagues, Wittgenstein's Poker, which to me is just an extraordinary representation of how a room full of brilliant people and a major event, and nobody sees it the same way. 15 minutes. It's not as if there was an extended event.
Yeah.
You know, no motion or very little motion, except of course the poker, and people could not agree on it. But that is substantially dramatically different from from changing time sequences, from changing characters, from putting people together who were not there together.
I am thrilled to be standing corrected. Now, can I do that?
Sitting corrected.
May I do that another way?
Would you like to try that again?
I would like to try that again. Fiction has so much truth.
Oh, yes.
That includes some things that are fact. And on the fiction side, it's not like it's make-believe for it to be fiction. How's that? Am I better?
Well, this is a degenerate notion of what truth is.
Yes.
We tend to think of truth and facts as identical, and that's something that
exactly
not the case.
There was that movie, Actual Malice, that said something can be accurate but not true. And I think that that is absolutely the case. I think about when we took an assignment in the Middle East and they described the apartment that we would be living in as being on an island in the Nile with a view of the pyramids and three bathrooms. And all of that was accurate, but none of it was really true.
Well, somebody had some pieces like that somewhere, but it wasn't yours.
There was a view of the pyramids in principle, but if you've been in Cairo, the dust is so thick you can't see it. And of the three bathrooms, you were lucky if one of them had a working toilet at any given time.
So. It wasn't occupied. Well, I guess that the thrill of your ability to give us fact-enriched stories that have truth in them when you are, in fact, writing fiction. There are lots of ways to get to the truth, and it would seem to me that having experienced being a world-class journalist for a big, worldwide, admired editorial paper, did I say that rightly? Mm-hmm. The reporting of the Wall Street Journal is widely and highly regarded.
Yeah, it's confusing to talk about editorial content.
Yes, I have to be careful when I do that. The mix of that, I would think, would be very inspiring to young writers.
Well, I hope. Yeah, so the more the merrier. I'm always trying to encourage young people to write about their experiences and then about their imagined worlds. And I actually think J.K. Rowling deserves to be given the highest honors in the land for what she's done, reintroducing kids to the big fat book and the pleasures thereof.
There was a recent article in the New Yorker about. But I can't remember the exact phrasing, but essentially the re-oralization of art, that people are reading less, particularly with respect to television. And the perspective, and I can't remember the book they were referencing, but it's the perspective is essentially a psychological perspective that we experience the world radically different as literate people than we do as oral.
We experience it differently, and it is a different world we experience.
The argument, and I think this is all very preliminary research, or at least thinking about it, I'm not sure that even the research, is that that oral cultures tend to be... tend to accept reality as it is presented and are less questioning
than literate ones.
Than literate cultures, which is both an interesting concept. It may not be true. The research to me is very thin, but it brings up some interesting challenges as we diminish our contact with real literature,
written literature. As opposed to that's done orally. You have to think about that while we take a quick break, and then we'll be right back, please, with Geraldine Brooks. Be with us. Geraldine Brooks has honored us with her presence here on The Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell has just brought up the subject of the aural, A-U-R-A-L, versus the written, as in literary.
Oral, not aural.
Oh, aural is to listen?
Oral to speak, spoken culture? I think that the difference is not so much about how the information is transmitted, it's what is it. And I think that oral culture is where story is important, are just as likely to experience the flights of imagination, the questioning, the wanting to know more. It's about story to me, not about the mechanism. I think our storytelling in our visual culture is getting a little impoverished. If you've been to the movies lately, we seem to want to tell the same kind of stories over and over again. But I don't think the Greeks had any trouble with raising questions of authority, and Homer being the great exemplar of great storytelling that was transmitted for many, many years orally.
Generations, over countless generations.
Millennia!
Several of them. Well, I do think of Julian Jaynes in this context in the origins of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind, which does go to this subject.
Which was not a bestseller, nor
not
did it win a Pulitzer.
but
it's
this
a deeply interesting story because it's about how did the human brain evolve to come to where we are.
Well, and these are substantive discussions, particularly in America, where our education system is not working well.
Broken.
To put it generously. There are lots of contributors to that. Obviously, television is a challenge.
My kid is in the public school, and it is a fantastic school. So I think we generalize too much. This school is doing a wonderful job of getting kids where they come in, including immigrant kids who don't have any English when they arrive. But I'll tell you what, they're reading and writing beautifully when they leave. So I think that we're too hard on our public schools. It depends on the support that they're getting from their local communities.
Absolutely. And we could do a whole lot more of that instead of simply testing children out of existence. I want to really conclude my thinking about what you've done to get a sense of what do you get up in the morning thinking when that blank page is still ahead of you. Is there still a joy to getting up and saying, ooh, I get to write today?
Oh, yeah, I can't wait to get to my desk. I get very churlish when I get interrupted and distracted.
So to what are we looking forward?
You mean that short little
books?
Story about having to go downstairs and get the express package is representative
absolutely, of your own? Absolutely, I'm afraid. Yes, at that point, Hannah Heath is entirely speaking for me.
Well, you have introduced us to amazing people, both of the book and people of your imagination. Thank you. We look forward to you coming back.
Thank you.
People of the Book brought us together with Geraldine Brooks, but not before inhaling deeply of her other fiction, including Year of Wonders and March. All are gripping, poignant, great stories, great literature. We look forward to much, much more from this extraordinary writer, and we thank her for being with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.